Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Classes of Mail. My name is Alan Gygax, and today I'm going to get through the rest of the election rules, unless they're longer than I'm expecting, and then I'll have to break it up again, but I'm pretty sure I can get the rest done. So, it is exciting. The last episode, I was named the nominee for Vice President of Branch 2502, so that's pretty cool. And campaigning is going on in full swing. In fact, if you are in Las Vegas, we are having Michael and Jonathan and I are having a campaign picnic. It is a potluck picnic that Michael reserved space down at Tule Springs Park. And so we're going to be down there Saturday, which is, whatever the day of the week. It looks like the 12th or no, Sunday the 13th. I'm sorry, Sunday the 13th. We're going to be down there from noon until whenever, so bring a dish to share and hang out with your fellow carriers. Should be a good time. It looks like turnout's going to be pretty solid. And you get to meet your candidates, Alan, Michael, and Jonathan. So, with that out of the way, let's get on to the election rules. 11.0, general election rules. 11.1, if there is only one candidate for any office, the branch president may declare that person elected. And that happened at my election for a couple of offices. I think it was the secretary and the treasurer both had just one person running, and so they won automatically. Oh, and there were some steward races like that, too. We also had some steward races where no people ran. All right, 11.2. When there are two or more candidates for any office, the election must be by secret ballot. Comments. A secret ballot election is one of the most, if not the most, important provisions of the LMRDA. That's the Labor Management Reporting and Disclosure Act. Branches must make any and all necessary arrangements to guarantee that no one can observe members voting. 11.3, a plurality of all votes cast determines the winner. So as a refresher, plurality just means whoever gets the most votes. You don't have to get more than 50%, you just have to get more than anybody else. 11.31, if there is a tie for the highest vote, a runoff election of the candidates who tied must be held within 30 days of the original election. 11.311, a notice of the runoff election must be mailed to each member at least 15 days before the date of the election. 11.312, if the runoff election results in another tie vote, the election shall be decided by the toss of a coin. All right, if that happens in your election, I have a pro tip for you. Tails never fails. All right. 11.4. Each regular branch member, as designed in Article 2, Section 1A of the NALC Constitution, is entitled to one vote for each position to be filled. 11.5. Any member who, for any reason, will be unable to vote during the times the polls are open may request an absentee ballot. Absentee ballots must be requested after nominations have been closed, but at least 2 weeks before the election. 11.6, the election must be held at the time, place, and in the manner announced in the election notice. So at my branch, the notice said that the election is going to be conducted by secret ballot. The ballots will be mailed out, and they must be received by November 6th at 4 p.m. That is the day that our votes will actually be counted at the next union meeting. So if you are in Las Vegas, make sure you get that ballot in. Make sure you check the box that says Alan Gygax, but more importantly, check the box that says Michael Brazemley, because as long as he gets in, we can totally right the ship, and we are going to be good to go. All right, next, 11.7. Voting must be at a branch meeting, unless branch bylaws provide for a different method. Alternate methods of voting, if authorized in branch bylaws, are A, at stations, followed by voting at branch meetings by members who did not vote at stations, Section 13.0. B, by mail, Section 14.0. C, at a polling place designated by the branch. 11.8, each candidate is entitled to have an observer present during the following election procedures. A, preparation and mailing of ballots in mail ballot elections. B, receipt and opening of ballots at each polling place. C, counting, tallying, and totaling of ballots. D, recording of tally sheets. 11.81, observers must be notified of dates and times for each procedure. 11.82, if there is more than one polling or counting place, observers may be present at each location. 11.83, a candidate is permitted to serve as his or her own observer. 11.84, observers do not have to be members of the branch. Comments. Observers serve as an additional safeguard for candidates and members to assure a fair election. Observers have the right and a duty to inform the election committee of any violation in the election procedures and to challenge any voter who is ineligible to vote. The following further classifies the role and limitations of election observers. A. Candidates can use alternate observers, for example, when polling hours are long and observers need to be relieved. B. Observers may make lists of the names of members voting so that candidates will be able to determine whether any unauthorized person voted. C. Observers should be carefully positioned in the polling area so as not to violate the privacy of voters while marking their ballots. D. Observers should not assist in conducting the election, for example, by helping to count votes, nor should they engage in campaigning at the polls. E. Candidates may have as many observers as necessary to observe the actual counting of ballots. Thus, if there is more than one counting table at a single location, observers may be present at each table. F. Observers have the right to maintain their own tabulation during the counting of ballots. Dude, that observer's going to be in there getting their nose in things. Sounds good. We're going to have to probably get an observer for ourselves. Although we've got a lot of people now who have volunteered to be election officials, and that should help. You know, the more people in there, the harder it is to pull off any impropriety. 12.0, voting at branch meetings. 12.1, the election committee must write the total number of ballots on the voting register at the time of actual balloting. 12.2, all voters must identify themselves before receiving a ballot. Upon receiving the ballot, the voter must sign the register of eligible voters. 12.21, no member can authorize another member to cast his or her vote. 12.22, proxy voting is prohibited. 12.3, at the time the polls are opened, observers may examine the ballot box to assure it is empty. It would have been a good idea just to put a bunch of filled out ballots in there in advance, but they're onto those shenanigans. That's probably one of those things that was learned the hard way. 12.4, voting machines, booths, screens, curtains, separate tables, or similar physical arrangements must be provided to ensure that voters can mark their ballots in secret. 12.41, voters must not be allowed to mark their ballots openly. 12.5, each candidate must be allowed to challenge the eligibility of any voter. Challenges should be handled in accordance with the regulations set forth in Challenges, Section 15. 12.6, the register of voters, unused ballots, and the ballot box containing marked ballots must be under the supervision of the election committee at all times. 12.7, unless the counting of ballots is done immediately after the balloting, Section 17, the election committee must seal the ballot box and deposit it in a locked place to which only the committee has access. Comments. It is recommended that all efforts be made to count the ballots immediately after balloting. However, if it is not possible, don't take the ballot box home with you for safekeeping. Yeah, that's good advice. Don't tape it up and stick it in an unlocked file cabinet or a file cabinet to which members or staff people have keys. Candidates or observers should be encouraged to view the sealing of the ballot box and the placing of the ballot box in a secure location. On to Section 13, voting at both stations and branch meetings. Voting at stations must follow the same election rules listed in Section 12, with the following additions and modifications. 13.1, voting at stations must be at least one day, but no more than 7 days before voting at the branch meeting. The date and time for voting at each station must be announced in the original election notice and also must be posted at least 5 days before balloting. 13.2, a working member is eligible to vote only at the station where the member works or at the branch meeting. 13.3, a retired member is eligible to vote at A, the branch meeting, or B, any station upon notice to the branch financial secretary or other responsible officer within 5 days after nominations of the station where he or she wishes to vote. 13.4, a member of the election committee should be present at each polling place and supervise all election procedures. 13.5, The election committee should provide approximately 5% more ballots than the number of members eligible to vote at each polling place. The total number of ballots at each station must be written on each station register. 13.6. In the event polling at stations takes place over several days, the election committee must seal the ballot boxes when the polls close at the end of one day, deposit them in a locked place, and reopen them when the polls reopen. Observers are entitled to be present at the sealing and reopening of all ballot boxes. 13.7. After the polls have finally closed at the stations, the election committee should count the number of used and unused ballots and the number of persons who have voted, and then write these numbers on each station register. The number of ballots used and the number of members who voted should be identical. 13.8. The election committee must then prepare another voting register consisting of those members who have not yet voted and who are thus eligible to vote at the branch meeting. 13.9. Voting at the branch meeting must follow the same election rules enumerated in Section 12, except the revised voting register must be used, and the branch may require members to vote by stations or take any other steps necessary to prevent double voting. On to Section 14, conducting mail balloting. And this is the most relevant to me since this is what we're going to do in my branch. 14.1. Observers may be present at each mail balloting procedure listed below. 14.2. At least 20 days before the pre-announced election date, which is the date by which ballots must be received in order to be counted, the election committee must mail first class to all eligible members at each member's last known home address, A, instruction for voting and the deadline for returning marked ballots, B, a ballot, C, a plain envelope marked secret ballot envelope, D, a prepaid business reply or stamped envelope addressed to the election committee at a post office box with a space for the member's signature, unless the branch uses an alternative identifier on the reply envelope to verify eligibility of the voter. See comments below following Section 14.3. And here's 14.3. Mail voting instructions must be clear and instruct the voter to do the following. A. How to indicate your choice of candidates. Do not sign your name, otherwise your ballot will be voided. Do not mark the ballot in any other way. B. Place the marked ballot in the secret ballot envelope. Do not mark the secret ballot envelope. And then there are some examples in here of what this would look like. C. Place the secret ballot envelope in the reply envelope. D. Seal the reply envelope. E. Sign the reply envelope in the upper left-hand corner, otherwise the ballot will be voided, unless the branch uses an alternative identifier on the reply envelope to verify the eligibility of the voter. And then F. Mail the reply envelope so that it is received no later than the specified date. Comments. Branches may use the traditional methods of verifying voter eligibility in a mail ballot election by requiring the voter to sign the reply envelope. Alternatively, branches may use technological means to place on each reply envelope a unique identifier which verifies the eligibility of the voter. 14.4. At the designated time and date, all mailed ballots should be collected by the election committee at the post office box and brought to the tally site. 14.5. The tally should be conducted immediately by the election committee. 14.6. The name or other identifier on each reply envelope should be checked against the list of eligible voters to verify the identity and hence eligibility of the voter. If a ballot is challenged, it must be put to one side and the procedures described in Section 15 should be followed in the processing of these ballots. 14.7. The reply envelopes should then be opened, separated from the secret ballot envelopes, and preserved along with all other election materials. The secret ballot envelopes should be placed in a ballot box. 14.8. Only when the verification process has been completed for all ballots should the secret ballot envelopes be opened, ballots removed, and counted. See Section 17. 15. Challenges. As stated in Sections 12.5, 14.6, and 16.4, each candidate must be allowed to challenge the eligibility of voters. All challenges must be made to the election committee. The following procedures govern challenges to voters. 15.1. If voting is at the branch meeting, or stations and the branch meeting, all challenges must be made prior to the placing of ballots in the ballot box. 15.11, each challenged voter must be given a ballot and an envelope with the voter's name and the words challenged ballot typed or written on it. 15.12, the voter should be instructed to mark the ballot in secret, fold the ballot, place it in the envelope, seal the envelope, and place it in the ballot box. 15.13, when the ballots are tallied, the challenged ballots must be put to one side and the unchallenged ballots counted separately. 15.2, in mail ballot elections, all challenges must be made when the election committee is verifying names or other identifiers on the reply envelopes against the list of eligible voters. 15.21, challenges must be made before the outer envelopes are opened. Yeah, that makes sense, right? Once you see like, oh, those people are that's voting for the wrong person, I'm going to challenge that one. Yeah, obviously you can't do that. 15.22, challenged ballots must be immediately put to one side. 15.23, when counting begins, unchallenged ballots should be counted first and separately. 15.3, for mail balloting, voting at the branch meeting, and voting at stations and the branch meeting, the election committee must first count the unchallenged ballots and then determine whether the number of challenged ballots is large enough to change the outcome of the election. That makes sense. If somebody wins by 100 votes and there's 7 challenged ballots, then don't worry about it. The person still wins, regardless of the outcome of the challenge. That seems perfectly reasonable. 15.31, if the number of challenged ballots is not large enough to change the outcome of the election, then the sealed challenged ballots need not be ruled upon by the committee or counted. These sealed envelopes, however, must be preserved along with all other election materials. 15.32, if the number of challenged ballots is great enough to possibly affect the outcome of the election, the committee must rule on each challenge. 15.321, if voting is at the branch meeting or stations in the branch meeting, the secret ballot envelope must be opened and, without examining the folded ballot, the election committee must deposit the ballot in the now empty ballot box. After the election committee has ruled on all challenges, the ballots in the box should be mixed together, counted, and added to the previous tally. 15.322, in mail ballot elections, the outer envelope of a challenge ballot must be removed and preserved along with all other election materials. The secret ballot envelope should be placed in a ballot box. After the election committee has ruled on all challenges, the secret ballot envelope should be mixed together, opened, counted, and added to the previous tally. 15.323, the final election tally must include the outcome of the election both with and without the challenged ballots. All right, making good progress here. 16, absentee ballots. 16.1, observers may be present at each absentee ballot procedure listed below. 16.2, before tabulating any votes, the absentee ballots must be picked up from the designated post office box by the election committee's chairperson or designee and immediately brought to the counting place. 16.3, the names or other identifiers on the reply envelopes should be checked against the signed voting registers. If a person has sent in an absentee ballot and has also signed a register, the absentee ballot should not be counted. However, it must be preserved for 1 year. And none of that double voting. That is not okay. 16.4, after the eligibility of all absentee ballots has been verified, the outer envelopes should be removed unless a ballot is challenged by a candidate. If a ballot is challenged, it should be put to one side, and the procedure described in Section 15 should be followed in the processing of these ballots. 16.5, the secret ballot envelopes should then be mixed with all the other ballots in the ballot box, and the counting of all unchallenged ballots should begin. And now we move on to Section 17, counting the ballots. Oh boy, this is the exciting stuff. We're getting close to the results here. 17.1, observers are entitled to be present when the ballot box is collected from the locked place prior to counting. 17.2, before counting any ballots, the election committee must bring absentee ballots to the counting place and follow the procedures in Section 16. 17.3, challenged ballot envelopes must be put to one side and the unchallenged ballots counted separately. 17.4, the election committee must count the ballots carefully in accordance with the following rules. 17.41, if a voter has signed his or her name on the ballot, the entire ballot is void. 17.42, write-in votes must not be counted. However, a write-in vote does not invalidate the rest of the ballot. 17.43, if a voter has incorrectly voted for more than one candidate for an office, the ballot is void only for the office incorrectly marked. 17.44, keep all voided ballots. 17.5, the election committee must count the number of used and unused ballots and the number of persons who voted and write these numbers on the voting register. Nice. 18, reporting election results. 18.1, the election committee must report the results of the election to the membership by posting the information at all stations, or publishing the results in the branch newspaper, or in some other appropriate manner. 19, preservation of election records. 19.1, after the election, the committee must deliver all election records to the recording secretary or other officer, if branch bylaws so provide. The election records include A, all used, unused, spoiled, void, and challenged ballots, B, eligibility lists, C, voting registers, D, mail ballot or absentee ballot envelopes, E, tally sheets. 19.2, all election records must be preserved for 1 year. Comments. Certification of the number and kind of ballots destroyed is not a substitute for preservation. Even those ballots voided because they were received late or because they were cast for an ineligible candidate must be preserved. The best way to comply with the law is to save absolutely everything. And 20, installation of local branch officers and certification of delegates. 20.1, installation of newly elected branch officers should take place at the first or second meeting of the branch following the election. Any current national officer, past president, or past president of a state association may act as installing officer. 20.2, if none of the above listed officers are able to attend, any officer of a state association or a past president of a branch may install the newly elected officers. I wonder who's going to do that at our election. I bet it'll be our state president, Mickey Grizzle. We shall see. 20.3, within 10 days of the election of delegates to the National Convention, the recording secretary of the branch should send the names and post office addresses of every newly elected delegate to the National Secretary-Treasurer. 20.4, within 10 days of the election of delegates to the state convention, the recording secretary of the branch must inform the secretary of the state association. This was one of the potential improprieties in our election, because there are members of our branch who are officers of the branch, I should say, who are automatically delegates to the state convention and to the national convention. And that's supposed to be listed in the election notice. And it was not listed in our election notice. All right, well, moving on. That brings us naturally to Section 21, Appeals. Internal Appeals Procedure. 21.1, all objections to the conduct of an election by an aggrieved member must be mailed to the chairperson of the branch election committee within 5 days after the date of the election. The appeal must be submitted in writing by certified mail return receipt requested and must include all supporting evidence. The election committee must respond in writing within 30 days. 21.2, any aggrieved member may appeal the decision of the election committee to the branch executive board within 5 days of the committee's decision. The appeal must be submitted in writing by certified mail return receipt requested. The branch executive board must respond in writing within 30 days. Branch bylaws can provide that such appeals be submitted to a group or body other than the branch executive board. 21.3, if an aggrieved member is dissatisfied with the ruling of the branch executive board, the member may appeal to the next scheduled meeting of the branch. Within 5 days after receiving the ruling of the branch executive board, the aggrieved member must notify the branch recording secretary of his or her intention to appeal to the branch. This notice must be in writing and sent by certified mail return receipt requested. Members present at the next scheduled meeting of the branch must decide the merits of the appeal. You know, if I were to make an issue of the notification, it would wind up being decided upon by the members of the executive board who put that notification out. And I have a pretty strong feeling of how that appeal would go. You know, obviously, as I've said before, job one is just win the election. 21.4. Any aggrieved member dissatisfied with the decision of the branch meeting may appeal to the NALC National Committee on Appeals, except for decisions concerning the election of delegates and alternate delegates to the national and state conventions. Further internal appeal procedures for delegates and alternate delegates to national and state conventions are provided for in sections 21.5 and 21.6. 21.41. An appeal to the National Committee on Appeals must be in writing and filed with the branch recording secretary within 20 days from the date of the branch decision. It must be sent by certified mail, return receipt requested, and should include any arguments, briefs, or other written testimony and evidence which the member chooses to submit. 21.42. At the regular meeting of the branch following receipt of the appeal, the recording secretary must present the appeal and all attached written materials to the members present at the meeting. 21.43. The branch then has 20 days to prepare its written reply. 21.44. The original of the appeal, all supporting material, and the reply of the branch must be sent via certified mail to the chairperson, Committee on Appeals at NALC headquarters in Washington, D.C. At the same time, a copy of the reply must be sent to the member who is appealing. 21.45. Any aggrieved member dissatisfied with the decision of the Committee on Appeals may appeal to the National Convention of the NALC in accordance with the procedures described in Article 11, Section 4 of the National Constitution. And I know at the last National Convention, we had some of those. There were people who were dissatisfied with the way the election went and took their appeals all the way to the convention. Further internal appeal procedures for delegates and alternate delegates to national and state conventions. 21.5. Any aggrieved member dissatisfied with the decision of the branch meeting with respect to the election of a delegate or alternate to the state association convention may appeal to the Credentials Committee of the State Association under the rules prescribed by the association. 21.51. Any aggrieved member dissatisfied with the ruling of the State Association Credentials Committee may appeal to the State Association Convention. 21.52. Any aggrieved member dissatisfied with the decision of the State Association Convention may appeal to the National Convention in accordance with the procedures described in Article 11, Section 4 of the National Constitution. 21.6. Any aggrieved member dissatisfied with the decision of the branch meeting with respect to the election of a delegate or alternate to the NALC National Convention may appeal to the Credentials Committee of the Convention before the opening of the convention. 21.61. Any aggrieved member dissatisfied with the decision of the Credentials Committee may appeal to the National Convention in accordance with the procedures described in Article 11, Section 4 of the National Constitution. All right, and then we have a big checklist here of all the things that people who are responsible for the election have to do, things that branch officers have to do, things the branch president has to do, things the secretary has to do. All of these things are in a big old checklist. There is also a time chart on the following pages that shows like how far out you're supposed to do each thing that you're supposed to do. So that's a handy little chart there. And then for the election committee, here's what you do when the voting begins. If you are voting at a branch meeting, these are actually all just condensed versions of all the rules that we've just read through. So I'm not going to bother reading through those again. And then there's a chart for the appeals procedure and what the different steps are of the appeals. And then that's it. We are done. After that is the index. All right, guys. Now we know how the elections are supposed to go, but we don't know how they're supposed to turn out. So hopefully my election is going to turn out for the good guys. But we shall see. You know, there's still this incumbency bias to overcome. And, you know, we can see things like the incumbents have been at here where I am, branch in my branch, the incumbents have been visiting stations a lot more frequently than they normally do. And is that campaigning? Yeah, of course it is. But can you prove that they're campaigning? No, because they're not going there and saying like, hey, everybody vote for me. You know, they're just making appearances, getting their name out, shaking hands, things like that. And that's something that me as a challenger, I'm not allowed to do. I can't go onto the workroom floor and say hello to everybody and remind everybody what my name is. And this is one of the reasons that incumbents have an easier time winning these elections. But I'm putting my best foot forward, and so is Michael, and we are going to do our best to restore the branch and get the ship righted. And thank you guys again for joining me in this, and I will keep you all posted. Next time, I'm not sure what we're going to do next time. Well, I guess we'll find out soon enough. All right, guys, take it easy. Thanks for listening.